Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce, and Dermot Cole of the Alaska Dispatch News. Paul, the Anchorage Assembly okays a compromise labor law, but it isn't over until Mayor Dan Sullivan has his say.
Mayor Dan Sullivan has a week from last Tuesday to have that say. AO 37 was passed in February of 2013. It's highly divisive. A lot of consternation about how it was introduced at the Assembly, the cutoff of testimony, one thing after another. It was highly controversial. They've been trying, it's now on the ballot, if you will.
In November.
A referendum to get rid of it. Assemblyman Johnston introduced a kind of a revised AO 37, AO 40, I think is what she called it. It would get rid of some of the things in AO 37 that were so offensive to the public employee unions, restoring the right to strike, things like that.
If I might, when I refer to having a say, that means he can veto it or
not. He can veto it or not. And it only passed 7-4, so there's not a guaranteed 8 to override a veto. And Mayor Sullivan is running for lieutenant governor. We were talking before the show, he has no opposition. Whether he'll veto it or not, anybody's guess. He's not saying. We're going to look at it and decide what to do.
Okay, and we have a few more days before that happens.
And the Assembly, by the way, has until August 18th, I think, to remove it from the ballot, ask that it be removed from the ballot.
Okay. Dermot Cole, the 8th and the 9th of August are the 40th anniversary of the resignation of President Richard Nixon. And it gets a lot of coverage. All the United States turn on the radio or frequently television. There are versions of that story or old footage. You've been looking at a special aspect of this, and that is how Alaska fared in the latter stages of the Nixon administration, especially the tapes that President Nixon had in the White House.
Well, yeah, right, Mike. This is of interest to people who are, let's say, seated around this table of a certain age, meaning ancient, right? So younger viewers are not going to know what we're talking about.
I did use the phrase 40th anniversary.
Right, the 40th anniversary. And so, yeah, so Nixon announced his resignation on August 8th, 1974, resigned the next day on August 9th. Well, I've been sort of immersed in part of the aspects of these tapes recently. While driving down here from Fairbanks, because I wanted to appear in person and not over Skype, I listened to much of the new John Dean book, which is based on about 1,000 conversations. And its great strength and its weakness is that it's based on the conversations, because they're lying to each other and to themselves many times. The Nixon taping system, which was installed by the president in 1971, really proved to be his undoing, because in the end, the smoking gun tape revealed that he had, raised the question of trying to get the FBI to back off of the Watergate investigation. Anyway, in terms of Alaska, Alaska comes up many times over in the tapes, and they really haven't been investigated, really. Historians have not gone through this, and really there's probably a lot more to be found. Of the 3,000 hours that have been released, publicly released, I sort of looked at a couple of key points. One was the day after Nick Begich disappeared and how Nixon responded to that.
That would be in October
of 1972.
Right.
Nick Begich, Representative Nick Begich, and Representative Hale Boggs and two others died in the plane crash while flying from Anchorage to Juneau. Nixon correctly predicted a couple things that day. One, that the plane would never be found, and two, that both men would be reelected, which they were. Interestingly enough, the tapes also include the phone conversation that Nixon had with Peggy Begich when he called her to, express his condolences. Nixon's immediate reaction was about politics and what this might be. Don Young came into office this way, really. He was on the ballot as a sort of a token candidate that year because Begich was expected to win easily. But Young lost that election, then won the special election the following winter.
Defeating Emolnadi.
Defeating Emolnadi. And then Nixon met Don Young and Jack Coghill March 15th, 1973, the day after Young was sworn in. And to me, what's really interesting to me about this is, as a sort of Watergate, somebody who's been interested in Watergate for a long time, this was 6 days before the John Dean told Nixon about that there was a cancer nearing the presidency and it was threatening his administration. In the same tape in which Nixon said maybe $1 million was needed and he knew where to get it. And he could get it in cash, which is, again, there's another thing that helped led to his undoing. But the discussion with Young and Coghill and Nixon is interesting because of the awareness that of Nixon showed about Alaska politics. It's pretty credible, really, that this is a very smart guy in terms of political strategy when it didn't deal with himself, you know, because he didn't really handle Watergate correctly. But his analysis, he said Ted Stevens was steady but not spectacular, which was sort of a good analysis of him. And of Mike Gravel, who was the other Alaska senator, he said he was a rat.
And sounds like George Raft there in an old movie.
Yes, well, he said, let's face it, Gravel's a rat. And he should be, you know.
That's good.
Yeah. And he talked about having what he could do to help defeat Mike Gravel in 1974.
And I believe Jack Coghill was there in his capacity as party executive?
And who had run Don Young's campaign in 1973. So, and Nixon said, you know, I owe that state. I'm not sure what he meant. He said, I owe that state now. So let's see what we can do to sort of beat Mike Gravel in 1974. Well, Nixon wasn't around by that time in 1974 to help defeat Mike Gravel, and Gravel was reelected then.
And one more thing here: when the election, when the Young-Nadi election was going on, Nixon had something to say about what if Nadi wins this election? Of sort of self-pitying.
That's
right?
True. At the end of this 20-minute conversation, and again, this is on the same day that he had a Watergate press conference, and he had an expletive. Press corps didn't ask him about the important things, which he said was about Vietnam. They all wanted to know about Watergate. Anyway, he said that had Nadi won, the headlines would have been Nixon repudiated, which is sort of, you know, the headlines wouldn't have been Nixon repudiated, but it shows his view of.
And listening to these tapes, did he actually say, let me say this about that?
Well, let me say this about that, Mike. He might very well have, but I listened to a lot of this John Dean book, and what he likes to really say is, and so forth and so on. So this is
dozens of times, I believe.
Yes, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I shouldn't, you know, if there were tapes of what I've said in my life, a lot of it would be embarrassing, I'm sure. But, of course, I wasn't president.
And of course, this is it's an interesting and important part of American history.
And
Tim.
Alaska history.
Well, I just would say, when things like this are discussed, it'd be fun if we had a telephone here. Gravel lives in San Francisco, where he's retired. It'd be fun just to call him up and say, did you hear Nixon called you a rat? What do you say about that?
There's one other aspect of this I'd like to mention. The taping system was revealed to the public in July 73, when a Nixon aide, Alexander Butterfield, basically had to answer under oath if there were tape recordings in the Oval Office, which there were. The system was immediately shut down. And in a way, Alaska history, we'd know a little bit more because at the end of that month, there was a meeting in which many Alaskans, Ted Stevens, Cliff Groh, I think, many others, went to Washington to talk to Nixon about the pipeline. And that was at the end of July 1973. There is no tape of that meeting, so we don't really know what was said. But we do know the discussion between Nixon, Young, and Coghill.
Okay, thank you very
and
much.
And so forth and so on.
And et cetera. Tim, sticking with the oil questions, Shell Oil and North Slope Native Corporations get together and sign a deal for Chukchi offshore leases. What's in the agreement? How soon might we expect action?
Well, this was a real surprise to everybody, Michael. You know, people have talked for years about the lack of federal revenue sharing, that people who live onshore, particularly coastal communities, have no, they carry all the risk of offshore development, oil spills, and they get none of the benefits. There's no sharing of revenues, unlike Louisiana. So we've talked for years about trying to get congressional legislation, and I think the chances of that are really nil, given this current federal fiscal climate. So it was interesting what Shell did. They volunteered to give the North Slope folks, the shareholders of all the corporations, village corporations and the regional corporations, an undefined, the option to bid and acquire an undefined royalty share of all the Chukchi leases. We don't know how much or what the financial terms are because those are confidential, but it's interesting. However, what's also interesting is the fact that this really, I went to the press conference where all the North Slope people, village corporation people came down and they signed the big picture photo op, they signed up the agreements. But what's interesting is that the North Slope folks have consistently said they're very uncomfortable with offshore development because of the spill. They favor onshore, but they've consistent offshore development. So you really wonder about this. What's also striking is that the tribal groups, of course, have a different view, and you wonder whether this is going to exacerbate the conflicts between the tribal groups and the villages and the corporations, which are money-making.
Is there any timeline here of when we could see activity? That's part of what makes this problematic to understand, right, or predict.
That's true, because it's not sure that Shell really will ever be able to drill out there. They hope now to return to the Arctic in 2015 and drill in the Chukchi Sea, but whether that happens is unknown yet. We have a court, interestingly, the court case that they're struggling with right now, writing a new EIS, is brought by the tribe of tribal entities of Point Hope. In the Point Hope Village Corporation is part of this deal.
So yeah, that's very interesting.
So go figure, you know. Wait,
now, are there any of the same people involved in the, well, obviously, some of the same people in the tribal entities are also involved in the corporations. Yeah. Does this deal give Shell some political support that it wouldn't have otherwise?
Well, I think that's probably the idea, is that Shell would be able to say that we have the local people that are tied into this economically. But more to your question, the... I think in actuality, this in Point Hope, what you're dealing with is small town politics. You have one group of people that are in charge of the tribe and another group of people that are in charge of the corporation. But in theory, the tribe represents the whole community. Mm-hmm. And of course, the village corporation, everybody in Point Hope is a shareholder of the village corporation. So you do have this seeds of a conflict.
Okay, once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Tim Bradner, and Dermot Cole, and let's go back to Dermot Cole with contemporary politics. Three major candidates for the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate square off in Fairbanks before the Chamber of Commerce. Dermot, you were there. What happened? What'd you see?
Well, as in the other debates that we've seen in the leading up to the Republican primary, which is where the, you know, other than the oil tax repeal, that's the real question on the August ballot. The Dan Sullivan, Joe Miller and Mead Treadwell are all sort of trying to be as conservative as possible, because I think that's where they believe the election will be determined. And in this debate, I wrote about it. The common thread was anti-Begich, anti-Obama, anti-EPA, and in favor of states' rights and more state control over land and resources. It's a sort of a familiar litany of issues in Alaska
politics.
This is
sometimes troubling for politicians to work out the sales pitch. Somebody says, I'm 100% against Obama, and the other person has to say, well, I'm 105% against Obama, and so forth, right? You have to demonstrate your rigor here.
But neither one of them is 110%, right? So that's the next level, apparently. The turn it up to 11, I guess. Yes, they're all, Mead Treadwell and Dan Sullivan really are the leading two candidates here. And you can sort of, I don't put much faith in polls. I really don't, but there's been a lot of news coverage about polls. You know, let's just, the only poll that counts is in August, as, you know, politicians once said. They're all trying to be as conservative as possible. After the primary, they will sort of back away from any of these stands. At least they might temper the rhetoric a bit. Well, they're still going to be anti-Begich and anti-Obama.
Well, I assume that this showed up their conservatism when they were asked or discussed abortion, right?
Well, at this particular debate, it didn't come up directly. It did come up earlier in the week at the Family Council debate, I believe. It did come up in the sense of Joe Miller and Mead Treadwell continue to go at each other over a initiative dealing with when life begins that Treadwell kept off the ballot. He said he did it because of legal precedent and that he was following the law. Joe Miller said that if Mead Treadwell really believes that life begins at conception under the Constitution, then Mead Treadwell had a constitutional duty to move ahead with that and not follow the Supreme Court. It's an interesting argument that
Joe Miller is carving out. Remember that Representative Kelly thought that Sarah Palin should go to jail rather than implement the law. That was on same-sex benefits.
Okay. The question then becomes, not just on that issue, when do you ignore the Supreme Court because of your beliefs, and when do you follow the Supreme Court despite your beliefs?
Yeah.
And that's a difficult question. And Treadwell and Miller are really light years apart on that.
Well, and we do know from American history that this is not confined to conservatives. In the Dred Scott case, fugitive slave law, the liberal anti-slave believers said they would just not follow the law and didn't in that case. Let's go back to Tim. Tim, Alaska's LNG project is buying land, securing access for a gas line. What are the specifics and what is to follow?
Well, this, I think when it came out that they've actually purchased property in Ekiski from people, that really began to make the project real to people. A lot of folks have always felt, even up until recently, that this is still more talk and more planning and things like that, more studies. But they've actually purchased land. They paid money. We don't know how much they paid, but they say they purchased about half of the amount of land they need for the terminal, 400 acres they need. They purchased about, 200 of that. They'd like to have more land. But I think that's a significant development. It shows a real intent.
If you own the other land that they need to buy, isn't this really good news for you?
You're next door.
These people who sold early think they might have waited a bit. Yeah.
But it's a very specific tract, and it's right. It's near adjacent to the old closed Agrium project in the Kiske industrial area.
Okay, and when we're talking about the Alaska LNG project and CAPS, who are we talking about?
Well, this is a consortium of the three North Slope producers, BP, Exxon, ConocoPhillips. TransCanada's involved because the state's also involved. So it's really five parties. The three producers are leading it. Actually, Exxon is in charge of the project because they own most of the gas. So that kind of puts them big dog in the show.
Okay. Paul Jenkins, I don't want to leave you out any longer. Let's get you back in here.
Free.
Election day is close at hand. An update. Some observers see the vote to repeal SB 21 as a close call. Is this possible given that the oil companies and their allies have put something like $15 million into their campaign, which I'm told is about 30 times what the yes folks have said?
It's not a surprise to me. There's several things that work here. One, people are making up their minds at this point. It started out, the question was trailing early on. I think they've managed to catch up and gain ground. But people at this point in this campaign are making up their minds. So we're going to be shifting back and forth. Elections always close up towards the end. And there is a huge deficit out there, I think, of information about what the oil industry is and does in this state. There's misconceptions about how much money goes where. There's misconceptions even at the state level about where this thing is and what
it
should
be. Wait
a minute,
Paul.
There's also a deficit of money, though, too.
I can understand that people may not understand it, but the information has been presented, and certainly the industry and lots of other people presenting it.
Here's the thing. I write a column. One person in 20 reads it. I write it again. Two more people see it. I write it again. Three people see it. And if you have to keep saying the same thing over and over and over and over again, and in this case, in every medium available, trying to get the information out. I think you can see where the money racks up pretty quick. The other side, the yes side, has an easier task. It's our oil. It's a bumper sticker campaign. It's hard to overcome a bumper sticker campaign. I don't care who you are.
It's a bumper sticker campaign on both sides.
Well, they've got the better bumper sticker, I think. It's easier to remember. These guys are trying to inform the public, educate the public, and bring the public up to speed for the election. And it's costing money.
Does it surprise you that there would be people who say they're undecided? I've met a couple, and I thought after all the discussion, the money's been spent and everything else.
I could walk out here, and we'll just stand on the street, stop 100 people. Half of them won't know who their congressman is. Most of them won't know there's an election in August. Some of them aren't sure they're in Alaska.
This raises a disturbing question. Why are we doing this show?
Well, it is a disturbing question.
Tim Bradner.
Just one final thought. I think that it may not be so much that people aren't getting or not understanding the information. I think they're just confused about who's right. Genuinely not sure. You know, I talk to Rotary groups around town about these issues, and these are people who are well-meaning, educated. Most of them are older business people, and they're really confused. They're not sure who's right because they hear such conflicting things.
To me, it's not a surprise why people would be confused. Yeah. This is a complicated underlying the superficial campaigns on both sides. It's a complicated issue. If people really wanted to know about this, they should have. Or they could go now and go back and listen to many of the hearings that took place on dull, yeah. And that's why they didn't listen to it.
Let's go back to Paul here for a second. I mean, here's a good example, I think, of what you're talking about. I went to this forum, which there were distinguished economists talking about the repeal, and people with good reputations who made a lifetime in Alaska came down very differently on this.
Sure. I mean, there are, intelligent people can disagree on this. And this is what the industry and spending that you're talking about has to overcome. It's got to say to you, look, I don't think you understand this. Let me keep throwing money at you till you understand. I'm going to keep educating you and bring you on my side. And that's what they're about.
Okay.
That's why it's expensive to do.
Tim, fishermen are complaining about Governor Sean Parnell's choice of his fisheries advisor, Ben Moore. They don't like his previous employment history.
Well, Michael, this is, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's election year. You hear a lot of things. Another chance to take a shot at Pebble, another chance to take a shot at the governor. You make an appointment that they don't like. In fact, as I understand it, he's a special assistant in the governor's office. He's really not in charge of commercial fisheries. Stephanie Moreland kept that portfolio when she went to the Department of Fish and Game. She's still the governor's advisor on commercial fisheries, as I understand it. What Moore is doing is more, I'm told he has a good reputation with sports fishermen, so he's handling that brief for the governor and also some hunting, guiding issues and things like that. So I think it's, to call him a fisheries advisor, he's not the same kind of fisheries advisor that other people have been in the past. And also, it's election season. People take their shots when they can. And but here in this case,
we do know from previous experience that usually anything that has to do with fisheries is significantly controversial.
That's right.
Okay. Dermot Cole, the bridge to somewhere. The largest bridge in Alaska is completed near Fairbanks, and politicians gather in celebration and recognition. The 3,300-foot bridge has a special use and won't be open to the public. Explain that to us. And first of all, I want to note, though, the Golden Gate Bridge is 8,980 feet long, for those who want a comparison, and the Brooklyn Bridge is 5,988 feet long. So this is a long bridge, but not that long.
Okay, but it's true about the Golden Gate and Brooklyn Bridge, but you know what they don't have? They don't cross the Tanana River east of Fairbanks. This is an unusual project. It definitely should be named after Ted Stevens, I think, because it's really there because of Ted Stevens largely and because of the Alaska legislature and Governor Sean Parnell. Cost close to $200 million. About $104 million of that came from the Department of Defense through Senator Stevens. It's envisioned as an eventual railroad link in the railroad that would extend to Delta and then east to the Yukon Territory and, Chicago. That's probably not going to happen between now and then.
And its short-run destiny is what?
Its short-run destiny is, there are no railroad tracks on it. There's sort of a gravel, it's a 12-foot-wide bridge. It is an engineering accomplishment. The Tanana River is a very difficult and wide river at that spot. It's going to be used for the time being by the Army and the Air Force to get equipment across the Tanana River to training grounds south of the Tanana River year-round. Now, this is of a different era in Alaska, frankly, because we're not going to get projects of this again. And people can debate the merits of whether or not this should have been built. It has been built. It was a big celebration there. People were very happy to see this built, and they kept talking enthusiastically about what the next step is. Well, the next step is $1 billion to Delta. So I don't see that happening.
You mean $1 billion to extend it to Big Delta? Is that what you're talking about?
Oh, yeah. Give or take a few hundred million. And so Stevens envisioned it as a railroad link. It's going to be used by the Army to, you know, get material across it.
And while we have Dermot Kohler, let's close on this number. Former legislator Fred Brown, 1943 to 2014, just died. He served 8 years in the House of Representatives. Remind us a little bit about Fred.
Yeah, Fred was a very interesting guy, a lawyer, grew up in Fairbanks. You know, you knew him quite well. Yeah. I knew him quite well. I mean, he never failed to remind me that I overslept on both the opening day of the legislature and that last day of the legislature in 1978. But Fred was an expert in telecommunications, and he served well in the Judiciary Committee, and was a really dedicated legislator.
And somebody who loved the work and loved the life. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.